know, things gathered from different cultures, things like
that. Well,
that's
what the oligarchy wanted. The oligarchy, and maybe those that could parallel world in that, they understood the pre-literate sensibility, and they wanted the world to go back to a pre-literate sensibility. That's what Larouche called the New Dark Ages. They wanted to return to feudal social structure with the oligarchs and royalties and the ten beasts of Europe in charge. And most of the intellectual leadership in the West was run by people favored of that view. They were into later the Gaia hypothesis, the global warming, the stopping of the growth of industry in the third world because it just caused more pollution. They were neo-Luddite, is what the real thought controllers of the world's global meme brought in, starting with the Kennedy assassination in 1963. And then the Beatles were the first thing, the first attack on the baby boomers. Then the Vietnam War was the next attack on the baby boomers. And then the whole threat of nuclear war was another thing. This was a project to make the natural brightness of the baby boomers to get distracted by fear of everything. Fear of nuclear war, fear of technology, fear of this, fear of that. And therefore we have this neurotic generation that was planned by British intelligence, which represented oligarchic intelligence in the City of London. That was, and it, since the world had come to a battle of the men's minds, since it was a global membrane, and memes and ideas were what controlled people, not starvation or other things like that in the first world. So it was a battle for ideas, and there was a whole agenda that that LaRouche documents, a biased agenda that was favored. The kind of concepts.
So how did they deal with this, given the fact that the printing press had given education to everybody so that everybody could read and write and think for themselves?
How did they deal with that? They obsoleted the printing press. They brought in the electric environment. They had no more printing press.
Oh, I see. That's very, wow. But they didn't burn the books. They just brought in something more attractive and easier to do with less effort.
Yeah, people's brains were massaged by the electric effect, which is largely tactile, and the 300 or 400-year period of the Gutenberg Galaxy where people were massaged by the printing press and its products, books and newspapers and pamphlets, that constitutive basic effect did not happen anymore. So you have what, you know, popular slang would say, mob rule, totalitarianism comes in with radio, all these mass phenomena where the American individual has an identity crisis because they're built on the printing press. So the American goes running around protecting the Gutenberg Galaxy under the name democracy against electric effect called communism. That was the battle of the 20th century. This show should be subtitled "The Education of Cha."
You bet. The re-education,
yeah.
The deprogramming.
Well, Coker would call it the miseducation. The miseducation of Cha.
Well, it's just like the first time I came on the radio, I just got shock after shock after shock because all my concepts have just been gradually shattered one after the other.
Right.
I mean, it's not very... I mean, do you know what it makes me feel like, Bob? It makes me feel like when I went for the past couple of years, I used to go to non-duality lectures, and where you were taught that you were equal value to a robot, and that, you know, there was nothing after you died. There was just nothing. And I just gave away all my books. I just felt that everything was useless and hopeless. I did.
Did you say, they believed that we were robots? Is that what you just said?
Well, no. I said to Tony Parsons, what's the difference between a person then and a robot? And he said, no difference at all. They have equal value.
And that's what Gurdjieff said. But Gurdjieff didn't believe in one life.
Mm. Well, I've been reading. I did read a bit of Velikovsky on Gurdjieff, but I didn't find it very easy to read, I have to say.
I don't think it's Velikovsky.
I struggled.
Velikovsky is the guy who had the comet hits the Earth theory. You mean Uspensky?
Uspensky, yes, you're correct.
Yeah.
I apologize.
Yeah.
That's quite right. And then just before I came on to Achieve Radio, I'd been reading The Secret History of the World by Elizabeth, and she's got a double-barreled name. That was very startling, but it's absolute nonsense after hearing what Ion has to say. So
yeah.
It just shows all these rabbit holes that the mind can go down. And think you're discovering things like Roxy's been... She's a kind of Roxy-type person who discovers everything about medieval things and the Kabbalah and all that kind of thing. And
yeah.
It seems very convincing, but it's more stuff and nonsense.
Well, Ion says that the printing press brought in the Dark Ages, so all reading, regardless of its content, is fallacious.
So,
and that's tough for a literate generation. So you write poetry. Are you part of any poetry circles in London?
Oh, no, I'd never be part of anything like that. I couldn't do it. I mean, I just write. I don't compose. You know, I just sit down and dash off little pieces.
So you've spent the last 50 years going to odd groups, esoteric groups?
Yes. Just the way you predicted.
Right. And what is the first one you joined? In your 20s or 30s?
The first thing I did was, in my 30s, my mother sent me to to some kind of alternative medicine show. Mm-hmm. And I saw a demonstration by a woman called Eve Taylor. And I went along and trained with her as an aromatherapist. It took 2 years, anatomy and physiology, basic exams, this, that, and the other. And I was so numb that when she stuck a barrow into my foot, I couldn't even feel it. I had so much what they call body armor. I just couldn't feel it. And so then when I worked as an aromatherapist, I worked in a big London teaching hospital, and I was the first person there, and I was interviewed thoroughly by everybody, and I worked with people who were very seriously ill with AIDS or diabetes or strokes or you name the worst things in the world that was on that ward. And I felt so inadequate that every single weekend, more or less, I went on workshops to improve myself and learn how I could be a better help to the people I saw, every week, once a week.
Yeah, you went to
that's
not
how I went to everything.
Workshop.
No,
right.
No,
not
I went to everything.
Everything else. Everything else.
Healing workshops, this kind of workshop.
Reiki?
No.
Reiki?
Not Reiki, no.
Theosophy?
But I did theosophy. I got caught up in that by the Lucis Trust, which is the Lucifer Trust, which I only discovered that recently. And
that's been exposed by LaRouche for 30 years.
Well, I had no idea. In fact, they sent me, they wanted me to be their office manager. They sent me a thing last week or the week before. So all that kind of thing, endless, everything. So,
well, there was lots of it in London.
But
no
the
shortage
thing is,
of groups.
Without somebody like Ion to tell you the truth, you don't know who you are or what you're doing. I mean, I didn't know I was non-physical. It's very strange to realize that your things are not what they seem to be.
Well, you're saying you didn't realize you're non-physical. What about theosophy? and talking about the etheric body and the astral realm.
Oh, well, I mean, I did all that with Manuel Schock, who was a wonderful man. He'd been brought up in a Swiss orphanage where he was chained to the bed by the nurses. They were very badly treated, but he could see all their energy fields and everything. And I read about him in the library in Bishopsgate, which is in the City of London. He was advertising a stillness weekend, so I went along to him, and that's where I learned, and I just went to that, and then somebody persuaded me to attend one of his groups, which lasted a year, where we met whenever he came to London. And that was, you know, I was in absolute awe of him because he had something I didn't know, you know, which was...
Right, but wouldn't you call that non-physical?
Yes, I would.
But iron presents a different non-physical then.
Well, iron is completely open, very easily approachable, and very easy and very patient and humorous. And...
Yeah.
You know, he just humors and copes with everything. So he's completely unhuman, really, compared to to a human who's got psychic
right.
abilities.
Right.
You know, he's just, I mean, you just can't, I cannot put into words what I feel about Ion.
Mm.
I just can't put it into words.
Well, Roxy was telling me last night that she basically is in love with Ion from the beginning. She loves Ion. Is that what you're expressing?
Well, I don't think Ion would like to be loved. I think he'd find it quite repellent. I know he ticked me off for writing a poem to him, and he ticked me off on the chat line for writing things I didn't fully understand, so I apologize. You know what I mean? Because it's not,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You don't want to, you know, you don't want to, just because you admire somebody. I can't quite explain it. It's
it's like you love Ion, but you're not allowed to express it in any way. Ion will not accept it.
Well, no, I wouldn't call it that. I would just call it, I don't think, personally, I can't share what Roxy feels because I've got a very different understanding of life. But for myself, I would say it's the first time in my life that anyone has ever explained to me accurately what, you know, about the most basic thing to the most tiny thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Would you say it's tiny?
Well, from the most ordinary thing to the most ordinary thing, which is of no interest to anybody else, but
to what?
It's, well, to the most extraordinary thing, like telling me that, you know, when you said you'd slept with my mother on the first time I spoke to you.
Did I say that? Yeah, I guess
you
I did.
You
yeah,
said, "Char, I
yeah.
fucked your mother." I was having difficulty, you know, the microchip kept disconnecting, and
yeah.
you know, my hair was falling all over my face, and I was in my dressing gown, and it was so exciting to talk to you after listening to you on Payback, you know, the whole thing. And then when I got this connection, he said, "Char, for heaven's sake, I fucked your mother." And I just said the first thing that came into my head, well, no wonder she didn't like me or something. I didn't consider what I was going to say. But, I mean, it was just, and so that's why I thought, well, I wonder if Bob's my father or if it was my father. Do you know what I mean? And that's why I
yeah.
asked Ion that, and that's why he explained to me that, I haven't come onto the planet by a normal route. But it makes me wonder. out of all the 6 billion people, and I know that Ion said that, I think he said the population of humans is approximately 5 billion. So that must mean that there are about 1 billion people who aren't human. I'm not saying they're non-physical, but they might be other species, or, you know, they might
be... Well, here's a statistic. Listen to this.
Tell me.
The beginning was there were 250,000 vampires in Los Angeles alone.
Yes.
So there's a lot of those, apparently.
Well, they do a lot of sacrificing in that area, which is, people have tried to stop it, but they do it to gods and things like that, which is very, very terrifying, to try and deal with. It's very ugly, particularly of children.
Well, you just pretend that Ion's got your back and relax about it.
Well, I'm not worried for myself. But I do pity children.
Hmm. Well, they know a lot. They are pretty powerful, and if they get transitioned, that's what they wanted. You know, Ian says, you know, if you're a mother and your child baby starts crawling towards the cliff, don't stop the baby. The baby, crawls off and dies. That's what the baby wanted, because the baby knows more than the parent.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the first shocking things Ian said way back there. Ian sort of plays down the role of parenting, you know, not much to be done if you're a parent.
Yeah. I agree.
So
King
what's
Farley's
the value
story
then?
Was a bit of an illustration of that, Bob.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, what? You asked me? What did you just say?
Kim Fowley's story that you read to us is an illustration of a child who seems to have a better take on what's going on than the parents.
Right, and the parents were sort of semi ionotic. They kind of left the guys, you're on your own, you know. They were quite extreme on that level. I don't think they understood what they were doing, but it's a kind of attitude that Ion says is good for children. But you don't have, no compassion for kids, or you don't be friendly to them. But their lives are none of your business.
Yes, and yet you say that, and yet everybody seems to be further up the scale, like somebody like Marshall McLuhan is behaving like a parent, telling people what's what and what they should think and what they shouldn't think. And if Ion's right, it means that actually it's up to each person to think what they like. They don't have to follow
right.
or even teach anything.
That's right. That's right.
Is it? Does that follow his logic or not?
Right, and Ion plays down the significance of thinking.
Mm.
You know, Ion's always saying we don't think.
Do you think that Kim Fowley is one of your meat sack bodies, Bob?
No. No, I don't think so. I'd have to ask Ion. I don't think about it, but I would have the question.
Yes.
I haven't had a chance to ask Ion that question yet.
No.
I don't.
It was quite disturbing, his story, I found.
Yeah.
It really was, particularly as he had to fix everything, and he had to fix things for other people, acting as a runner.
It was, I don't consider him an example of a balanced life. Like Zappa's an example of a balanced life, not Kim Fowley. I mean, in the end, all he had was his interesting childhood story. Once he got into the 20s and was working in the record business, his book is boring. He's just saying, he's dropping
boring.
Names and saying, did this guy, did that guy, and that was that. It was interesting, say, up to 68, when he actually went to Britain and he lived with Keith Moon and all those early rockers, or the British Invasion. He got involved with them after being in the at the foundation headquarters in L.A., then he went to the British thing. So that was pretty remarkable who he hung out with. But after 68, 69, is stupid. There's nothing much. It's just him running around on a not much income, hustling to survive. Anyway, I guess he was pretty good at that.
I wondered if he'd been like Jimmy Savile, supplying a paedophile ring for people or something, you know, whether he had some other business on the side which enabled him to, you know,
right.
survive and keep company with people. But back to the question about the other,
let me just
other 1 billion people.
I don't see that, but I don't know. In the second book, which never got written, second, third volumes, he might have confessed that. But I think he was more like a pimp. He got access to girls,
exactly.
young girls, moved them around a lot. I think he might even didn't like pederasties. You know, he was against is that what you were just saying?
No, I just wondered if he supplied, you know, exactly
you
just said.
Right.
But,
well, that's a pimp. That's right. Yeah.
But you said that there. You said that Ion said a long time ago that there were 250 vampires in L.A. But that
250,000.
Oh, 250,000. Sorry.
Yeah.
But that still leaves a lot of millions of people who are unaccounted for. On the planet, who aren't human.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know if Ion includes that figure of the people
who are
on the surface.
The other ones are Lemurians. Ike distorts it, but they come out of Easter Island, and they were chased out of Easter Island in around 2,000 years ago by the Roman ships, and they just spread around the planet. And they are... not human, but I guess they can look human. And they're not as accomplished as humans, but because humans don't know what they can do, as on some level, they can fool humans, just because humans haven't entertained the possibility of that kind of being. But once humans catch on to what they are, I think the humans are smarter than them. Is what Ian said.
But do you think there are several million of them to make
up? I don't know how many Lemurians, but it sounds
billion.
Like I don't know how many. He didn't give a number for Lemurians, but it sounds like there's a lot.
Because I had million. A question about different populations. You know, what was the population of this, of this, of this, of this? But I mean, it's. It's just mind-boggling.
What kind of education did you have before you got aromatherapy?
Oh, I just went to boarding school. I had a basic education.
You didn't go to university?
No, I wanted to go, but my stepfather came to me and he said I'd have to earn my own living. So I decided... to become a secretary immediately.
Right, so you had a unsophisticated early life.
Yes, and so as a secretary, I was able to witness all these big business people in action, which is what I said on the first talk to Ion and yourself, was I had a lot of responsibility, but no authority.
Yeah. And you would be a secretary for corporate people?
Yes, for the head of a bank, that kind of thing.
Right, right.
Or,
so that would give you an education that a lot of people wouldn't see. You would see the mask of the authorities. You would see through their mask.
Yes, yes. That's absolutely
accurate. And that might alienate you. Right. Then you didn't go into aromatherapy because you got alienated and became agnostic. You just stumbled into it.
I just stumbled into it on the side. I did it on the side. I never gave up my day job.
Right.
I just did it on the side.
So what did that make? Did you vote? Were you interested in politics?
I believe that it was my duty to vote.
Even though you could see they weren't as impressive as the voters thought?
Not because of that, but because, in the reign of Edward I, before the reign of Edward I, all those years ago in England, there were just serfs. And Edward I brought in, I think it was common law or some sort of law, so that people had the chance to escape their plight. You know, they could at least have some sort of life of their own, determined by their own efforts, rather than being sent off to war or being sent to do this or this. And I think that that's a great privilege, because there are many people in the world who have absolutely no rights whatsoever.
So you're talking about Edward I. That goes back like 1,000 years ago, right?
Well, it goes back about 500, or I don't know. Ion would tell you.
500 years ago.
Yes, he definitely made a difference in this country.
So King John with the Magna Carta begins it, and then Edward I does something later.
I think it was probably the other way around. But I may be wrong. I don't know. I'm not educated.
I'll look up Edward I.
I think he was called Edward
John. King John is 800 years ago.
Oh, okay. He supplied the Magna Carta.
Edward I. He was King of England 1272 to 1307, so, 800 years ago. And who's his father? The first son of Henry III. And then you have Henry II, who's a key king. He acquires Ireland. Around the date of Finnegan's Wake, 1132. So this is a little, couple of steps down. You got Henry I, then Henry II, then Henry III, then Edward. So it's way back there. That's close to King the Magna Carta. When's that? So way more than 500 years ago. Magna Carta is 1215, and Edward I, he was king from 1272, so he's a little just past that. They say, the barons, the first son of Henry III, Edward was involved early in the political intrigues of his father's reign, which include an outright rebellion by the English barons. In 1259, he briefly sided with the baronial reform movement. After reconciliation with his father, however, he remained loyal throughout the subsequent armed conflict known as the Second Barons' War. After the Battle of Lewes, Edward was hostage to the rebellious barons, but escaped after a few months and joined the fight against Simon de Montfort. With England pacified, when England beat these guys, Edward joined the Ninth Crusade to the Holy Land. And on his way back from the Crusades, he was informed his father died, so he'd be making a slow return. He reached England in 2 years later, and was crowned at Westminster on 19th of August. So,
and do you think he sat on that special throne of scone or whatever that would get? Did they?
Unless it occasionally gets removed from England, but every coronation happens on that.
Mm.
You ever heard of Herbert W. Armstrong, the Worldwide Church of God?
Never. No. Has anybody else? No.
Maybe not here, but he's well known in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in North America. And the Queen acknowledged him, and he would explain the Stone of Scone and how it came from Jesus and all that, Jesus' relatives.
Have you checked that with Ion, see if it's accurate?
I don't know if I checked that, but I assume it isn't. That's a good
point. Because I bet Ion would have a few words to say about somebody that.
Yeah. Well, Herbert W. Armstrong says there's bloodlines, and Ion or the Evergreens said these bloodlines are not too strong, but that was before Ion started saying many of these aristocrats didn't die. So their bloodlines are not going through 2,000 years of mutation. They're here and can create their bloodline because they never left where they came from, and they are living in the future as well as here. So they have to go into that with Ion about the bloodline mythology.
That would destroy the linear idea of a bloodline then, Bob.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm thinking.
Why would that be?
Well, if you're always around, there's not one then the other then the other then the other.
Yeah, you keep creating children.
Hmm.
There's never any time for the bloodline to grow through itself, unless these kids, it's counting, you know, that his children, Leopold II's children have kids, and those kids have kids, it goes along like that. That's linear, but the father of it, Leopold II, is still making children and still here. So, more mind-boggling stuff that has to be asked about. I don't think that we have, we just sort of gotten now to the realm that Ion speaks about or can see. There's many Michaels, there's all these people didn't die, they're active politically. We've just gathered enough new facts to begin to ask Ion questions on top of that.
So are you saying this particular group of people form part of the uncounted, you know, the 6 billion, but the between 5 and 6 billion people who aren't chipped? Because I think, I wondered if Ion, because I asked Ion about the chipping or something, and he said, we've got most, I think, did he say we've got 2/3 of them or 4/5 of them? We've just got another fifth to get about everybody being chipped. And I was going to ask him whether he chips all the meat sack bodies. He must, I mean, if they're chipping, they must chip everybody thoroughly.
It doesn't necessarily have to be planted in the brain, though.
Well, it could be planted in your temple quite easily.
Or your arm. Maybe your arm. But I don't know.
Yes.
Well, the Evergreens predicted that humans would become 2/3 metal at some point. And I think that would be, I imagine, liquid metal, not, bars of steel.
Hmm. Like our new blood.
I would say you already are liquid metal. That's how they would go a little further than I than the evergreens.
Mm. By taking the RNA drops.
No, just all time is happening now. So all that you're going to be is there beside you that you can recall. There's no linear progression. There's no time. No linear progression.
Mm. So we're just catching up with everything.
Yeah.
And bringing it into one. Into one.
Into, no, using it in your words.
Into your knowing, which emerges in your
words. No, your words. Your words. It might include knowing, but what you can say is expanded by ion. You have to, you have new thoughts about existence. So you can say a whole range of things that you never would think of saying. And that's why I say one should listen to ion regardless. Should listen to anybody. They'll tell you something you haven't heard.
Absolutely.
So that that becomes your part of your repertoire, your armamentarium. Armamentarium, maybe that's how you say it.
But this is where the this is where, if you are being manipulated by the oligarchy to be deliberately to be dumped down, then they can ensure that you only receive things that are going to dumb you down and stop you from being in your full power. Whereas so the words can, they, it can be a double-edged sword. It can work one way or the other, is what I'm sensing. If
yeah.
you're with ion, then it will enhance you. But if you're being dumbed down deliberately, then it will diminish you into, it will fracture your hologram into to more and more pieces, so they become more blurred.
Bob, if words don't create, then what does?
Movement.
The new clothes you're wearing, the cars, the cell phones, all the new media.
That creates.
Yeah, I think that's replaced words. Now, it's McLuhan says all technologies are words. So they are wordy. They have the same linguistic characteristics as words, but they're not limited to the mouth words. There's the words of your texting, of your watching and responding to Facebook and stuff. There's a lot of communication that's happening to you that's not word-based. So that becomes a new means of creativity, but Ion says words are still powerful.
Yeah, but that's creativity. As creator gods, how is one creating?
Probably just recalling. Creation is recalling.
Oh.
And that gets into the Akashic Record idea, which Ion doesn't like. But the soul deposited in the guff all these unrealized creations. So unrealized creations is what creativity accesses.
Mm.
And they would be, the question is, are they an extension of us or a amputation, a delimitation of us, like the printing press was?
Mm. Mm. But are clothes and cell phones and those, is that not just an outward reflection of what we've created? Or is that how one creates?
Well, that's part of the question. Are you... what was my question? I just said it.
Don't create.
The creations that are put in the guff aren't realized. Mm. Are they extensions of talents that an ascended person has? So extensions are, creations are extensions of the human. What is an extension of the non-human? and probably wouldn't require the normal machinery. But that's what you got to ask Ayn about.
The most recent thing that Ayn said about that was that when he said that words no longer create, he then said movement creates, was his most recent comment.
And you're moving on your cell phone. You're involved in the world of movement. To the degree that Namakun say there's no movement in the global membrane, but most people imagine, okay, I'm talking to John Lennon, so I've moved across the ocean. You know, and that may be an erroneous image, but I would include the immobile, paralyzed, discarnate global membrane space as a kind of movement, even though it's not really movement.
Bob.
Yes.
This is Will. How's it going?
Okay.
Yeah. Would you consider like being on the internet as movement then?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Electronic is. Disembodied existence, and
right.
It's not really movement. You have to understand it's not movement. It's not kinetic physical movement, but with Ayn brought into it, there might be levels of movement that were beyond McLuhan's sort of crude sensory characteristics. But obviously, there's no movement here with me talking to you guys or you talking among yourselves, so it's really important to understand tactility is not movement. And therefore, in McLuhan's principle that the old environment becomes archetypal and intensity, then movement becomes archetypal intensity. Kinetic movement may be inside the tactile ground becomes important, but it becomes an art form. That's fitting McLuhan.
So is Ayn saying that communicating over... like disembodied communication is no longer creating?
No, he said words are no longer creating.
Okay, but movement is.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, like, communicating via the internet is not movement.
I don't know. That's what McLuhan would say that. I don't know what Ayn would say about it.
Huh. Okay.
You know, Ayn doesn't agree with McLuhan much. He puts down McLuhan a lot. But movement, creating is like driving your car. That's movement. You're creating spaces. You're impinging on the environment when you drive. And when you, just basically driving. Driving is a major movement medium.
Right.
And most people engage in a lot of driving.
I'm driving right now.
And then the telephone is creation without movement. It's a frequency.
That may suggest, too, Bob, that words are no longer words.
That's what McLuhan would say. They just melt away. They have no constituent power. The phrase... Joyce used in Finnegan's Wake was the annihilation of the etym, E-T-Y-M, you know, etymology. Annihilation of etym. And he has that right before, a few pages, just before the central page on television. And television annihilates the etym, in McLuhan terms.
And yet Dr. Carolyn is absolutely adamant that your words create your health and you should not talk negatively, and she encourages people to take their health as their own responsibility and to speak positively about the achievements they've made, be they 20% or not exactly 100, as a mark of progress. And I think from my observations of patients and things, I think words are in terms of recovery, back to remembering what's beside you or catching up with what you are, if there is no time, then words are quite important.
What did I say? Ayn said, when he says words don't create, and what's the rest of the sentence? I've said it several times the past hour.
I'm ashamed to say I can't think of it.
Yeah. He said words
they
don't create,
power.
But they are very powerful.
Oh,
so
thank
Carol
you.
So, about the power level of them. So you have to start asking questions of Ion, what's the difference between creation and power?
Yeah, I was going to, a thought came to mind that we're discussing what creation is and we're discussing what the word is. It's like two sides of a formula. It's like words don't create anymore. So what creates? Well, what is, does it mean to create? And so there's all these different factors of the formula that we can break down and discuss with Ion now.
Right, and remember McLuhan's point. His big discovery was that all technologies were words, and he would put words in italics. So the word, the verbal medium, mutated into other forms in the realm of creativity. And I guess they become vortices of power. I mean, that's the major message of the vortices,
yeah.
James Joyce and then McLuhan. That's the point here. And then Ion comes in to somehow push it past that, or to clarify it, or get you to ask some questions about McLuhan that you hadn't thought of. So we've just arrived at those questions. When Ion comes back, you guys should be just jumping on them. There should be no silence. There should be many questions on these points.
But in the beginning was the...
Jim?
Bob?
Yeah, go ahead.
In the beginning was the word.
And so what is the word?
The word. Well, this is now an extension of that word because we're now moving into movement. And Ion's drive, from what I understand, is that we need to get back into our power, and words don't create. Movement now creates. But I think words still have an incredibly powerful place in that movement towards power.
Well, you shouldn't
so?
Say what you think. You should ask Ion.
I should ask Ion.
Yeah, what? Who cares about your thinking? Yeah, I think that words have power. Well, the Gospel of Nick is very puny around here.
Sure is, Bob.
Yeah, with Ion. Now, he goes, they say, in the beginning. There ain't no beginning. So the words create, certain words with their concepts maybe create a sense of beginning. A pseudo-beginning.
In that moment, the beginning, yes. Because there is no...
Now, I've asked these questions. I've gone at Ion a lot on these kind of questions, chicken and egg questions, and it's not that satisfying, their answer. They don't respond well to my x-ray. Well, you said it. Which it are you itting about? You know what I mean? The language is often sloppy.
So it might be more accurate to say in the beginning... Instead of in the beginning was the word, in the word was the beginning.
Gosh.
Yes. In the beginning, the word created the beginning.
And also, Web
hey,
Point 2, that also did something to words, Bob, because everybody just started blabbering off and no one was listening, and that must have somehow impacted that whole.
Well, they were gods. And they weren't concerned about others. Who knows how they blabbled? I mean, that's where Zappa's movie, Captain Beefheart versus the Grunt People. That's a pretty interesting title. But what made people connect? Were they kind of singing to each other? You know, doing frequencies on each other? If there was this early caveman level, I don't know. If caveman in the early years of Taunton Ion was a symbol for the ascended continent, described the caveman as pretty an interesting phenomenon. Like they didn't, when they died, they didn't know they died. It was such a little change. So there's a question.
And Kreda Mutwa actually speaks about that too in his book, where he says, in their timeline about 300,000 years ago that humans weren't really physical. It was in his consciousness, it was only when the creepies came along, or the reptilians in their story came along, which I think is where David Icke is plagiarizing all his stuff from. But
who's the guy? Who's the writer?
David Icke. Kwita Mutwa.
Kwita Mutwa. Oh, I never heard of that name.
Kwita Mutwa. Yeah. Kredomutwa. Mutwa.
Oh, you went to high school with this person. This is a South African person?
No. No, this was the African Senussi he passed on the oral history of Africa, and in the oral history of Africa...
Yeah, but the name looks like a Zulu name. What is he?
Yes, he is a Zulu. He's a Zulu.
Yeah, right. And doesn't somebody went to fucking high school with. I was right. I mean, metaphorically. Now we're hearing the nationalist... patriotic mythology of the South African. They have their secret gurus, Kwita Mutwa.
No, he's not our guru. He's David Icke's guru, Bob.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes, that's where David Icke is stealing all his reptilian nonsense from. He's coming from Kwita Mutwa.
But he lived in South Africa. How did David have access? He's had his books?
He came over here and he visited with him and all sorts of things ages ago.
Well, how would you find out about him? Who published him? Michael, give us the background. Who published Kwita Mutwa?
Well, I got it from a musician here. When I left South Africa, a musician here gave me Kwita Mutwa's book called Cry, Beloved Africa, or Indaba, My Africa. I can't quite remember the title. And in that book,
Kwita Mutwa very small presses. The Penguin Books did not publish it. This is like, you know,
I think they were internationally available, but it was a very specific readership. But that book contains the oral history of Africa, is what's unique about that book.
Yeah, that's
and
cool.
In that oral history, they speak about humans as not being physical or sexually orientated, no male or female, beyond 300,000 years ago in their timeline.
That would be a pale version of what Ion says. He wouldn't say they weren't sexually active. They had they were like translucent skin that had orgasms all over their skin. You know, there would be a non-human part of it. What?
Yeah, they weren't male or female. There was no sex.
I would agree with that. But he would give us, you know, chapter and verse on the chemistry and the genetic structure more than Mr. Mutwa would tell us.
Yeah.
I'm dropping the M and putting in N. You know, Mutwa, you're saying. I'm saying Mutwa. Mutwa.
Yeah.
What nut? Kwita. That's fun. I've never heard of this guy. I learned a new name that I can toss at my colleagues at appropriate times.
Your colleague.
You know, the ones who live in the past.
Yeah.
At your next Club 22 meeting.
Yeah, I should make Kwita Mutwa Holy Office number 11. A new Holy Office, Kwita Mutwa. That's pretty good, Michael. You made a big contribution here. You expanded my vocabulary. Of course, I'll always say, when I do say it to my colleagues, I'll always say Mutwa. That'll be the joke, my inside joke. And they'll look about and go, don't you mean Mutwa? Some call him Mutwa, but I call him Mutwa. That would be the
history
conversation. Yeah. Now, some female voice way back there 2 minutes ago, 3 minutes ago said, hey, Bob, who was that?
Jean.
It was Jean.
Oh, Jean.
Who?
Can you hear me? Okay, I've got him. Sean.
Oh, Sean. Yes, Sean. Yeah, Cornwall. Yes. What was your statement going to be?
Some of the spell stuff I thought was when you were talking about the technology coming, the words and those things. And I saw witches use emojis. And so that's something on your phone, and you pick the emojis and cast your spell. And then they say what's the most important is you being clear on what the emoji means. And then I had this anomaly where today I got home with Jamie, and she asked me, is the cat home? And I said, no, because the cat is with the kid's father at the other caravan. And she was quite upset. She said, well, I wanted the cat home, blah, blah. I said, no, no, it's not here. And as we got in the home, she all of a sudden goes, oh, here's the cat. And she, there's the cat on the couch. And we're loving the cat and all over it. And all of a sudden, she's got a concern on her face. And I look, and something's strange about the cat. And I'm like, this is not our cat. And then all of a sudden, we completely freaked out. So we're stepping away from it. We're like, no, what is this? What is this? And so I phone my daughter at her dad's, my other daughter. She's at her dad's house. And I say, is the cat there? And she says, yes. Yeah, it's lying on my lap. And I'm like, oh, my God, there's this cat that looks just like our cat. But then, here's the thing with the story. On the counter, right here by the television, today Eileen did spell casting. And on my session with Ian, Ian told me to get a yod and pointed at Hebrew. So me and Eileen made yods, and I made her make her own one. And she today...
I'm missing some of your words. What are you saying? You made something?
A yod. It's like a Jewish...
Oh, a yod. Y-A-D? I see, yeah.
What's that? Yeah. What is that?
It's like when the Jews read the Torah.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
It's like a...
A what?
Yeah, I don't know.
Be, pointer?
Yeah. Yeah, it's supposed to be the idea. It's an extension of your hand. So it's pointing, yeah?
Yeah.
But I sort of said make the yod so it's not so intense, so that you don't, it's not so intense. Anyway, Eileen today, just out of the blue, came to me, and she had paper plates, and she said to me, write down what I want. And she pulled her yod out, and she wrote there, cat one. And I said, what? And she said, I want a cat that's 1 year old. And I said, no, that's very old. That's our cat's not even one. She said, no, I want a 1 year old cat. And she pointed her yod at it. And so I realized, here's this big cat that's definitely 1 year old. That looks just like our other cat. But anyway, so we created...
Yeah, but are you saying, wait. The yod pointing is before you discover the cat or after you had the cat?
Before, she did this today.
Oh, and then you found the cat later.
Yes, in my house, lying on the couch.
Right. Well, that's pretty good.
I was freaked out, Bob. It was that old,
Oh, how old is Eileen?
So I don't know if it's disappointing.
How old is Eileen?
Five.
Oh, the youngest one did
this.
So she said she created a yod, and then said, I want a cat, and you got one.
Yes, and she said a one-year-old cat. They said the number one is next to cat. Because for some reason, I even argued to her and said, no, don't you want a kitten? She said, no. And this was the first thing Jamie noticed about this cat is was it was bigger than our cat. That's how we thought, no, our cat's not this big. Yeah, so it was
so
fun.
She pointed and said, I want a cat. Then you left the home. And then you came back, and it was there.
Yes. Yes, this afternoon. I made a little video of it. I'll put it on your private message.
Okay.
Show you the cat and where the little paper plate is that she wrote on.
Well.
The show is about to begin.
Yes, this is the beginning.
I will be using my regular voice now.
Yes. Oh, what's that? Sarah said something?
Yay! I will be
quiet,
using my regular voice now.